from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Colin Smith.
And I'm Max Nesterak.
This week on War News Radio, looking forward, we first hear about similarities between the Occupy movement and the Arab Spring.
Then, we hear about future directions the Occupy movement could take.
Finally, we learn about the challenges that U.S. soldiers returning home from Iraq will face in the job market.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Three simultaneous attacks struck Kabul, Kandahar City, and Mazar-e-Sharif in Afghanistan. In the largest of the attacks, at least 55 Shiite worshippers were killed and 160 wounded in Kabul when a suicide bomber detonated explosives at a shrine where people had gathered to commemorate the Shiite holiday of Ashura. Though the Taliban brutality persecuted the ethnic Hazara minority, who make up Afghanistan's Shiite population in a Sunni-majority country, no explicitly sectarian attacks have taken place since the beginning of the United States' involvement in 2001. The Pakistani Sunni extremist group Lashkar-e-Jhanvi has claimed responsibility for the attacks. There are suspicions that some combination of the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and Pakistan's ISI were masterminds of the attacks, aiming at further destabilizing Afghanistan.
As the number of U.S. troops in Iraq declines, violence in the country continues. 18 people were killed in two attacks in Iraq's eastern Sunni province of Diyala. In the town of Khali, north of Baghdad, 10 were killed when a car bomb exploded in a market, while elsewhere, forces stormed an anti-Al-Qaeda leader's home, killing 8. In central Iraq, including Baghdad, at least 30 people have been killed in bombings. The attacks targeted Shiite pilgrims celebrating the festival of Ashura. Later in this week's program, War News Radio's Sophia Athanasiadis looks at the employment picture for U.S. veterans soon returning from Iraq.
United States President Barack Obama spoke with Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari, offering condolences for the NATO airstrike which killed 24 Pakistani troops on November 26. Stopping short of an official apology, Obama characterized the airstrikes as regrettable but not deliberate. The call, along with a conversation between U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Pakistani Prime Minister Yusuf Gilani, has been the latest in a string of attempts by the U.S. to ease tensions in the region. The incident has ignited anti-American sentiments in Pakistan, where many accuse their government of being submissive to U.S. interests. In response to the airstrike, Pakistan is demanding the removal of U.S. troops from an airbase and has cut off two important NATO supply lines. The country has also decided to boycott the Bonn Conference, held to discuss the future of Afghanistan, and has given permission to Pakistani troops at the Afghanistan border to return fire in the event of an attack.
More recently, Pakistani Prime Minister Zardari has flown to Dubai for treatment for what was reportedly a minor heart attack. While his aides say he will not quit, Zardari's questionable health has raised concerns that he will not be able to hold on to power. Zardari's Pakistan People's Party is waning in popularity as the country faces a declining economy and continued hostilities carried out by Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
United States officials confirmed that an unmanned stealth drone aircraft has crashed in Iran. The official Iranian news agency says Iran's military shot down the aircraft when it ventured 140 miles into their airspace near the town of Kashmar. However, the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force reports the vehicle, an RQ-170 Sentinel, crashed after a malfunction. U.S. officials say the Sentinel is one of a fleet of drones that has been flying reconnaissance missions to Iran from a base in Shindid, Afghanistan for years. According to manufacturer Lockheed Martin, the aircraft is flown remotely through a direct satellite connection, but will automatically return to its base if this connection is interrupted.
The European Union is struggling to enact an embargo on Iranian oil, intended as a sanction against Iran's nuclear development. Some traders and analysts say the measure could hurt some European countries with higher fuel prices as Europe struggles with its own financial troubles. Italy, Greece, and Spain, who are already struggling with significant debt, are the most dependent on crude oil from Iran. The Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, says Europe could face retaliation if it enacts the embargo. And Iran says it might enact a reverse embargo on the West. Iran is the world's fifth largest oil exporter, delivering about one-tenth of all of OPEC's oil.
Amnesty International is calling on the United States to stop shipments of arms and tear gas to security forces in Egypt, Amnesty says the shipments must stop until there is clear evidence that the equipment is not linked to violence on Egyptian streets. Amnesty also called on Egypt to train security forces and riot police to meet UN standards on the use of force and firearms. The U.S. State Department says that they are monitoring the security in Egypt closely and condemned the excessive use of force and the misuse of tear gas. In late November, Egyptian demonstrators collected empty canisters of tear gas used by Egyptian security forces and complained that they could be identified as having been manufactured in the U.S. This is War News Radio. On September 17th, the Occupy Wall Street movement began with a march of 1,000 protesters through the streets of Lower Manhattan. Since then, upwards of 950 cities in at least 8 different countries have held their own protests. War News Radio's Sarah Blazevich speaks to commentators from the United States and the Middle East about the similarities between the Occupy movement and the Arab Spring.
Activists and journalists have raised the question of whether Americans should look to the Arab Spring as an indicator of where the Occupy movement is going. This analogy is particularly relevant with regard to the 2012 presidential election in the United States. Saad Atshan is a Palestinian lecturer in peace and conflict studies at Tufts University. He shares his thoughts on how the two movements are connected.
Recession is hitting America very hard, and unemployment rates are really skyrocketing, and this is creating a sense of, you know, deep concern among the youth, and I think that allows them to really connect with their counterparts who are in the Middle East, where we face a huge problem with particularly these two issues of, which are also related, of youth hopelessness and also of there being very high unemployment rates.
An alumnus of Swarthmore College, a small liberal arts school near Philadelphia, and War News Radio's parent institution, Atshan talks about how young people in the Middle East did not grow up in the economic boom of the 1990s that today's American youth experienced. This has caused Arab youth to become cognizant of inequitable economic systems more rapidly than American youth. One of the nice things about the movement in Egypt, says Atshan, is that it was socioeconomically diverse, with both very wealthy and very poor Egyptians taking to the streets.
It brought together people from so many different walks of life, both Christians and Muslims. There's very powerful joint, you know, interfaith protests.
Douglas Knoll, a full-time mediator and law professor specializing in intractable conflict at San Joaquin College of Law in California, agrees that both the Occupy movement and the Arab Spring are rooted in similar perceptions of economic and political injustice.
It's been labeled as Occupy Wall Street, but really it's turned out to be a global protest. It started in Israel and, you know, sort of was patterned after protests in the Arab world, but now has gotten traction everywhere. And what we see is a protest against a perception of gross distributive injustice.
Knoll describes distributive injustice as an imbalance in how resources around the world are concentrated, leading to wealth consolidating in the hands of a very few while the middle class has essentially been economically eviscerated. However, Knoll sees some fundamental differences in the experiences motivating the two movements.
I mean, in every single country where there has been unrest, Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, now Syria, Yemen, Bahrain, people are resisting not only an economic injustice, but also autocratic regimes where people do not have a representative government and where the autocrats, instead of being benign, gentle dictators, have been brutal.
For this reason, Knoll says that it's not productive to compare the Occupy movement to,
you know, a protest in Tunisia or in Egypt, where you are protesting against an autocracy that, you know, is fundamentally oppressing your civil rights, even your basic right to assemble and speak out against the government.
In a discussion with American journalism students, Nada Awadi, a Bahraini journalist and writer currently living in Washington, D.C., disagreed with Knoll's analysis. Awadi, who fled Bahrain after witnessing the government crackdown last spring, says that the Occupy movement was hugely inspired by the Arab Spring and is rooted in all of the same problems. Awadi described the in-depth coverage that Occupy Wall Street has received in the Middle East and the sense of pride and validation that Occupy has given Arab Spring activists. Haider Hamzaz, an Iraqi social media activist working in Baghdad, thinks that the important connection between the movements is the shared learning experience that they have catalyzed for activists around the world.
I think not just the United States, all the world, they learn from Arab Spring that if they need the freedom, they can do it, like what happened in Tunis, Egypt, and other countries. If they need to do that, they can do it, but still using the peaceful demonstrations, peaceful tools.
Hamza says that the most important thing that the movements have in common is the prominence of new media platforms, which have enabled a new democratic form. Atshan agrees that the role of the media has been tremendous, especially that of Arab news organizations within the Middle East.
What was really great about Al Jazeera's coverage, it was live during the Egyptian revolution. From your living room, you felt as if you were in Tahrir Square. So it was really, I think, exciting to be in the region at that time when it was being followed very closely by most people and vigorously debated and discussed.
Atshan says that the Arab media was very much on top of its coverage of the protests and delivered thoughtful, comprehensive reporting.
Now, I'm not sure that we can say the same about the Occupy movement in the U.S. I think that the media coverage is getting better, but I'm not sure that they're getting the coverage that they need to be getting.
He talks about how this disparity has only fueled impetus for the protests in the United States, as the strong link between the mainstream media in the U.S. and the rest of the corporate world is one of the things being protested. Still, there are distinguishing elements missing from the protests in the U.S.
I'm not sure yet that we see the law enforcement officials being sympathetic to the protesters and to the demands and needs of the protesters, and accommodating them in the way that they should be accommodated. So that, I think that's also a critical factor. If we see more media coverage and we see more cracks within the establishment.
Awadi says that Occupy has been largely ignored by the American media because it is a movement that is, quote, working against the system, and the mainstream media is embedded in this system. The main issue right now, says Awadi, is figuring out how to create your own media. Noel sees different factors at play in determining the staying power of the movement.
So I think the Occupy Wall Street movement has the potential, if it can be energized and harnessed by a leader who can resonate with what these people are saying, can be a very powerful force of change. Until that leadership arises and emerges, it's just going to be this kind of inchoate mass of unhappiness.
Noel connects this to his studies as a peacemaker and international mediator, believing the movement to be a potential determinant of the outcome of the 2012 U.S. presidential election.
Eventually, a leader will step up, and hopefully not a charlatan, and hopefully not an ideologue, but that's always possible. And if that person is able to capture the emotion of what these protesters are feeling, that person's going to have a very powerful movement behind him or her.
He says that the people who are energized to protest, a group whose numbers are steadily growing, will subsequently be energized to vote.
It will not become an issue unless it is still going strong at the time of the general election contest at the end of next summer into next fall.
According to Noel, if the Occupy movement is still going strong by next fall and the Republicans still have not given it credence, they will jeopardize their competitiveness in the election. Awadi says this movement will lead to something big, whether it's in politics or in the streets. For War News Radio, I'm Sarah Blazevich.
This is War News Radio. Occupy Wall Street has amplified the voices of Americans feeling economic burdens, but the group's leaderless structure has left open questions about whether or not the movement's momentum will diminish, or if it will evolve into a powerful entity. War News Radio's Lucia Luna Victoria talked to experts about the possibility of emerging Occupy leadership.
The Occupy movement is a campaign to expose social and economic incongruities that began as Occupy Wall Street in September. More influences have come from the protests in Spain, Greece, the Arab Spring, and the success of the Egyptian and Libyan revolutions. Duke University professor of literature Michael Hart defines issues driving the movement.
There has been, you know, at least since 2008, the recognition of social, financial, political problems related to the control of finance, economic inequalities in the U.S., all these sorts of things.
The Occupy movement's growth suggests redirecting its structure to a more organized form that will have a strong influence in the 2012 presidential elections. A clear definition or leader could be the next step. Hart admits that the revolutions have helped some Americans express their discontent more openly.
They did provide inspiration and a way of imagining how we could do it.
The Occupy movement has reciprocated the influences from the Arab Spring, inspiring movements in other parts of the globe. Heather Godney, an assistant professor of anthropology at Fordham University, presents the next challenge in the evolution of the Occupy movement.
This is a popular movement, and so you have a variety of actors coming from different kinds of organizations like unions or, you know, community organizations or NGOs, even political parties. So in order to accommodate or respect the autonomy of these different institutions, you can't have these sort of formalized, centralized leadership structures.
Author Robert Monks, who has written Corpocracy and New Global Investors, believes there are certain similarities between Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party in that they both express discomfort with the U.S., but they are manifested in different forms.
The Tea Party seems to be reasonably well organized and financed and with a capacity to produce candidates and to produce funding for those candidates and to function in a competitive political environment. The Occupy Wall Street movement appears to be far more spontaneous. It doesn't appear to have a platform or affiliation with the conventional political system or the resources to pursue specific objectives like the Tea Party does.
Hart puts forth a different understanding of the Occupy movement structure.
I think that what I would call it is the horizontal or network structure of the movement, really on a horizontal basis. Yeah, think of it as equality, people on the same plane. And which, of course, doesn't mean that it's disorganized. In fact, it means that there has to be much more attention paid to organization and figuring out ways to organize in an equal or democratic way.
Anastasia Karklina, a sophomore at Duke University currently organizing the Occupy Duke movement, agrees.
It provides some sort of democratic platform for people to make their voice heard. And while there's a lot of criticism of the movement saying that there's lack of focus or certain agenda and demands, I think nationally it's a great opportunity for people from different walks of life, from different backgrounds, to come together and actually discuss the pressuring issues that this country is facing.
Hart agrees and sees a logic in the approach.
That form of organizing to me seems particularly appropriate if one of the concerns of the movement is about democracy itself. So it seems that a social movement should practice and even experiment with what it's aiming for at a social scale.
University of Southern California sociologist Nina Elisoff presents the need for the Occupy movement to produce not a leader but a spokesperson.
A spokesperson is just supposed to give voice to the ideas that the group has come up with. And so they're not supposed to initiate anything. They're just supposed to report a coherent message. And they're not supposed to take the group anywhere new.
Gutney supports the concept of a spokesperson versus a leader.
If the movement had leaders, then there would be a fear that the political orientation of a given leader or group of leaders would be the sort of political identity of this movement. And so in order to avoid this kind of infighting and I think reduction of the issues, they've opted to maintain this kind of network structure.
Garney explains the importance of having decision-making bodies.
when things need to get done, then representation becomes, you know, a kind of necessity.
Elisov believes that each Occupy should appoint their own spokesperson, and eventually some coordination would be useful at a national level. Gotney agrees.
I think it's going to be a little different. That local Occupies will have their own path and their own experience.
Horizontal or network movements are not new for the U.S., and there have been shares of successes and failures. The eventual organization and structuring of the Occupy movement could result in the amount of potency it will have on the election. Only time will tell if the Occupy movement will create any permanent changes in the U.S. political or economic spheres. For War News Radio, I am Lucia Luna Victoria.
This is War News Radio. It's no secret that finding a job in today's labor market is a difficult task, and even more difficult for those returning home from military service abroad. War News Radio's Sophia Athanasiadis spoke with U.S. military veterans to hear about the struggles soldiers face as they come home to record-high unemployment and few job opportunities.
Albert DiBello, retired U.S. Army Staff Sergeant, came home from Afghanistan in 2007 to find out that his old job had moved to Mexico during his tour of duty. Today, he works selling newspapers outside Philadelphia's City Hall.
I ended up using up all my money. I lost my truck. I ended up living on the streets, unable to find work. And the worst thing of all, I fell into the cracks.
Experiences such as those faced by DiBello, who served in Afghanistan for 2 years, are not rare within the veteran community, but rather a common reality for the nearly 1 million U.S. vets currently reported as unemployed by the Department of Labor. As these numbers continue to rise, Congress races to pass meaningful legislation to fight veteran unemployment and prepare the job market for the upcoming influx of returning service members at the end of this year.
Over the next 2 months, our troops in Iraq, tens of thousands of them, will pack up their gear and board convoys for the journey home.
For many of these individuals, however, life will not be much easier after the war, as they will be met with the near impossible task of trying to re-enter the workforce amidst widespread joblessness and catastrophic unemployment rates. In response to the president's October announcement of complete U.S. troop withdrawal from Iraq, DiBello predicts disaster.
When the president said that he's bringing our troops home in the next 2 months, November and December, these guys and women are going to be coming back to the struggles of no work. 30% are going to end up homeless within the next 6 months.
Although a bold prediction, his claim is grounded in some fact. According to a November 4th news release by the Bureau of Labor Statistics at the U.S. Department of Labor, the unemployment rate for post-9/11 veterans is 12.1%, which is over 3 points higher than the national civilian unemployment rate of 9%.
You get out of the military, you don't have like a lot of resources. You don't have a big, you know, reserve of money, or you know you're ready to move on. You're starting from scratch by and large.
That was Michael Blecker, founder of the Coalition for Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans and executive director for Swords to Plowshares, a veterans' rights organization based in San Francisco.
These folks are, you know, they're part of the 1%, the fact that 1% only fight the wars, but then they, of course, immediately join the other 99% once they're out. And like everybody, they're struggling at these near poverty levels and trying to get decent jobs, and that's a real struggle.
Blecker, who served in the U.S. Army Combat Infantry in Vietnam from 1967 to 1970 and has dedicated most of his life to helping veterans readjust to civilian life, notes a major difference in the challenges facing the veterans of today and those in the post-Vietnam era.
Everybody's been in the service knows that once they get out, boy, they're starting from scratch. I'm just saying it's really much harder to start from scratch in the year 2011 than it was to start from scratch any other time in our history.
Often, returning veterans struggle to become hired because they lack the experience and credentials of their civilian counterparts. Many times, however, there are other complicating factors that stand in the way of becoming hired.
Our veterans are coming home, or some of them are coming home with mental problems, and no one's going to be coming home the same as they left. I found out the hard way. You know, I got post-traumatic stress disorder from Afghanistan. Some days I can cope, some days I can't.
the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that over 170,000 post-9/11 veterans have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, an anxiety disorder which can develop after experiencing a psychologically traumatic event.
It's a unique situation to recover from repeated combat stress, and that's what the current veterans have had to go through with these multiple deployments.
A recent study published by the New England Journal of Medicine reports that roughly 1 in 8 returning soldiers suffers from PTSD. The study explains that less than half of those affected by the disorder seek medical help for fear of jeopardizing their career and being perceived by potential employers as high risk or unstable. Blecker explains that the reasoning behind this fear makes sense and is part of the reason why veterans are often overlooked as employees.
I think there's been a big change from how the nation, the country, society perceives veterans. You have a scenario where people actually have a better understanding and appreciation of what it means to be deployed multiple times and to fight these wars. And so there's a quote, you would think there'd be the political will, but we're up against, in one sense, the new vets are up against much more pinched system.
Although perhaps lacking, political will to meet the needs of veterans is not completely absent from Washington, where people like U.S. Senator Patty Murray of Washington State, who serves as chairwoman of the Veterans Affairs Committee, have made great strides in the campaign to end veteran unemployment.
We have men and women who serve on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan 24/7 in the most severe medical conditions, serving as medics, come home, and they can't even drive an ambulance or service an EMT. They have to start all over at the very beginning.
Until recently, the government as a whole had made very few efforts to properly address this issue and advocate for veterans' rights.
Since the 70s, there's been a tremendous cutback on care and government services and public sector services, and everything's been ratcheted down.
On November 21st, however, President Obama signed into law the bipartisan Vow to Hire Heroes Act, which passed in the Senate by a vote of 95-0. This law will offer employers tax credits as an incentive to hire veterans and will be extremely helpful to people like DiBello during the difficult transition from combat to career.
I have an AS degree in computer engineering, and I tried to find work in that field. And I couldn't find anything.
Ending veteran unemployment, however, requires more than just a shift in policy. In addition to progress at the governmental level, Blecker says that in order to see positive change, local communities have to play their part as well.
There's very little program, meaningful programs, put them in any better position to get work. There's just less resources available at the community level than there's ever been. So we're seeing that impact.
Although the passage of the VOW Act indicates progress, the true test of its success will be the fast-approaching homecoming of nearly 60,000 workers. The hope is that employers will begin to see veterans as attractive applicants so that the United States can welcome these service members home with increased opportunities. Whether or not the tax credits are enough of an incentive will become clear within the coming months. For War News Radio, I'm Sophia Athanasiotis.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Alan Zhao, Eliana Biscard Church, Natalia Choi, Amy DePiro, Yuan Chu, and Anushka Mehta. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Max Nesterak.
And I'm Colin Smith. Until next time, thanks for listening.